The Bookfingo podcast is a lively discussion about romance books, culture, and new adult fiction. This is episode 23, featuring Adele Walsh at the Romantic Times Convention in Las Vegas. Bookfingo would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which this episode was produced and pay respects to their elders, both past and present.
Welcome to the Bookfingo podcast, talking about books we love, especially Kill a Fairy Fast on the Bookfingo podcast.
Welcome back to the Bookfingo podcast. I'm Kat Mayo from bookfingo.com.au, an Aussie blog for romance readers. Three episodes ago, we had Adele Walsh and Claire Parnell from Melbourne on the show to talk about literary festivals. In this episode, I have a more in-depth chat with Adele, just before we parted ways in Las Vegas after the Romantic Times convention. Adele is the program coordinator at the Centre for Youth Literature at the State Library of Victoria. This means she is totally clued in on what's happening in young adult fiction in Australia, and she provides an insider perspective on the literary industry that I could never get as a reader. Adele is also a huge romance reader and advocate. In fact, I first met her online through her now-defunct blog dedicated to historical romance. You can find information on all the books we talk about in this episode by going to bookfingo.com.au/podcast and clicking on episode number 23.
I am the program coordinator at the Centre for Youth Literature at the State Library of Victoria, which means I'm into YA. As an offset of that, I'm really into new adult and trying to figure out where that actually fits. And outside of work, I'm actually a big fan of romance. I've been reading it since I was really probably too young for it. And I was lucky enough to receive a UNESCO Melbourne City of Literature grant to come and check out romance programming and YA programming. So RT was the perfect combination of both.
So I know that as part of this grant, you're going to a few other festivals. So where are you off to next?
I'm off to Houston, Texas, for the Texas Library Association Conference. And I have a little bit of a break, and then I'm heading to Santa Monica for the Your West, which is a YA festival run by a combination of people, including authors, booksellers, a public school, a public library, and a teen ambassador program. So it's fascinating public YA programming.
I have been quietly watching some of the cues for YA authors during the Romantic Times convention, and it's amazing to me that some of the longest lines for authors are for YA or NA authors. Do you have a sense of why YA is so popular amongst romance readers?
I would say it's particularly American YA is really popular with romance readers because there is a very strong vein of YA and romance aren't that dissimilar, I don't think. They're very emotionally rich, and they're very much about the agency of females, although YA can be about a dude as well. But I'm not surprised. There's something quite eternal about the first.
First
romance.
Love,
it
first
used to be
kiss.
First love, first kiss, first boink.
That's an official librarian term.
True. So I think there are commonalities. YA, of course, can cross all genres just like romance can as well. So they have those things in common. And a lot of authors do write in both YA and romance. They're multi-pronged, or they're multi-pronged within romance itself in all its subgenres, and typically written by women.
So you mentioned that US YA is popular. What's the difference between YA in the US and YA in Australia?
YA in Australia doesn't seem to have a YA romance subgenre. If romance exists in Australian YA, it's typically the B or the C storyline. It's never the number one, no. I know that Hardy Grant or Egmont tried, I think, 2 or 3 years ago with a special line. I don't think it did very well. It was looking at romance as a primary storyline.
So does that mean it's the US market that's driving the demand for YA romance?
I believe so, yes. Okay. If you look at authors like Sarah Jessen, who have been around for 15, 20 years. This weekend we had Suzanne Colasanti. And then you've got also New Adult, which is sort of bridging the gap between YA and romance.
So this is interesting. We've had many debates. You and I and other people online have had many debates over
I guess the borders between YA, new adult, and romance.
Mm-hmm.
What's your take on the new adult genre and where it fits in that spectrum or Venn diagram or whatever it is?
I agree with new adult authors in that it is not YA with sex. I disagree that they don't have anything to do with YA. They share a very similar protagonist in some age, and sometimes those overlap. But I believe firmly that new adult is a subset of contemporary romance.
I think new adult is emerging as its own genre, same as young adult, but just with a very large romance subset, which is interesting.
Interesting. It's weird because people are categorized as new adult, and sometimes I disagree.
I think it's because readers don't really understand what this genre is, and I think also it came from, like, the romantic part of young adult. So I think it's just really confused at the moment. I wanted to ask you, actually, what trends you see emerging in new adult as a subgenre or as a genre? Is it still first person is still the most predominant?
I think new adult has... Fuck, another plane.
Nice, put that in, Rudy. That was an appropriate librarian speak.
I forgot where I was at.
New adult trends.
New adult trends. I don't really think they have their own, particularly. There is first person, there is third person, there's stuff in there. It isn't recognised a lot for having first person, but I do think there's shades in that. I went to a panel and that it was on new adult and future trends, which was not a very good panel, to be frank. They got very bogged down in the idea that it's YA with sex or it's YA with not sex or whatever. Like, I just don't care. Like, it's...
Well, it's funny when people say YA with sex, because in Australia, YA doesn't shy away from sex. I mean, it might not be graphic, but there's no sort of this... There's no unwritten requirement that you must not have any sexual encounters. I mean, even Melina Marqueta's books either imply sexual activity or Angelica Rowe, they have sex. It's just not very dwelled upon.
Well, there's cunnilingus in the Piper Sun, so I don't think you'd typically get that in a YA book.
Was that between Will and Francesca in the corner?
No, it's between Tara and...
No, really? Was that during the phone call?
No, it's before the phone call. It was the night before.
I'm going to have to read the book again. I missed that. Can't believe it.
It is a good book to read. It also uses a C-bomb, which you don't usually get in your... I don't think I've ever seen in a YA book before. And that's the thing. The Piper Sun by Melina Marqueta and I guess Summer Skin by Kirsty Eager would be considered new adult. But I don't think they have anything in common at all with what people recognise as new adult in the romance scene.
This is true because it really depends on if you categorise new adult as the age of the protagonist.
Yeah.
So similar to sort of YA, the way YA is categorised. Or if you categorise it based on the style of writing. Which I think is why a lot of people tend to think of it as a subset of romance, because the style is very intense, emotional, very internal sort of conflicts, I guess.
Marqueta and Eager can be considered literary. I think you could also read them on a commercial level as well.
They're just exceptional authors.
They're exceptional human beings too. But I will say...
That's right. You're just rubbing that in. Like, seriously.
But I don't think particularly like Jennifer Almatrout, who's very, very popular, can write anywhere near the level of those two ladies. But she is the pillar of new adults.
I guess popular fiction and new adult.
But there's also some sort of comfort in new adult that the people that are very successful at it write something and then write something very similar to it again and again and again, which is similar. And I love Sarah Dessen, and she's a YA romance writer. She gets a lot of grief for being formulaic, and I can see why people would think that. But she also brings a lot of different. She always has equal parts. There's a romance. There's a family component, and then there's like a self-realization thing going on as well, a goal. So she does a lot within that. And, you know, I think she's like 12 books in at this point, and it's not. I can see similarities between that YA and the new adult that's becoming quite commercially popular.
And the way you phrase that. That reminds me of romance, because romance has imprints with a, for lack of a better word, a promise to the reader about what's going to be in those books. And so when you start talking about authors who write similarly themed, similarly where the tone of the books are similar.
Mm.
That reminds me of romance imprint branding.
Well, and romance in itself is a promise of a happily ever after. So there is this contract with the reader that if you're going to read this, there, no matter what that journey is, you're going to get to the point you want to be at by the end.
Do you think new adult promises a happily ever after?
I think it's a happily ever now.
Okay. I don't distinguish. It's just a happily
ever. Yeah, I do think they confuse lust and love quite a lot. Well, because sometimes...
I mean, they do that in romance too, right?
Sometimes I don't really know... don't really see them like lasting very long and a lot of the times they're just so angsty they just get in their own way, like it's...
But do you think it's that much different from adult romance? I mean, think of the paranormals where you think, really?
I don't really choose to read a lot of the YA paranormal. Yeah. I'm not a paranormal reader, so I will say my sample is somewhat restricted by that. That being said, you know, I really like Cressida Cole, so she's my sort of exception to that rule.
She's written erotica too. Have you read her erotica?
No. Oh. Interestingly, I've got these weird little conditions. Cressida Cole, I read her YA and that's it. So the Arcana Chronicles, yeah, which I really, really enjoy. And you know, a lot of YA romance, I mean, people always freaking mention Twilight, which I think we need to move on from.
Well, okay, so but, Twilight is a series. Yeah. Do we consider series as romance, where the happy ending is prolonged over several books, and you don't get the resolution till the end? Because some romance readers think it must be in the same book. And I think the emerging romance readers that are younger probably have a more fluid definition of when the happy ending has to happen.
Ooh, you're really... tweaking my brain right now. I would primarily consider it to be like a paranormal series rather than a romance series, but I think we always talk about it in romantic sense rather than the vampire sense, because the vampire stuff isn't particularly well
done.
Do you
think it's because we're talking to two different groups? One is the general reading audience and one is the romance audience, and when we talk about Twilight as a romance, we're talking about the general audience, not the romance audience, because the romance audience already knows what a romance is.
Yeah, I think the other thing is... there were a lot of people reading well before Twilight, in terms of teenagers, and they read Twilight, but they moved on and went back to the stuff that they were reading before that and enjoyed more. But the people who discovered reading or rediscovered reading from Twilight probably is to... I was going to say to blame, but that's not fair. The birth of a new adult probably has something to do with that a little bit as well.
Right.
That dam of readers needed a place to reside.
Well, I always feel like it's because Twilight just didn't have... the right amount of sex for the kind of emotional intensity that it had gone for.
Mm.
And so readers feel a bit, not cheated, but they felt that there was something missing, that sexual component was missing. And so people wrote their fanfic and then people wrote stories that are similar but with heavier sexual content. I always feel like when YA authors refrain from the sexual stuff, but a lot of the build-up is around sexual tension, then you get this imbalance and readers aren't quite satisfied at the end because...
Yeah. Well, I think the other thing is vampires are quite carnal. It's that bloodlust thing, and yet that it was very much subverted with Twilight. So
I feel like for a story about vampires who went to high school... there was not enough oral sex in Twilight because, honestly, women menstruate every month.
Yeah.
I feel like this would have been smorgasbord. Everyone in that school should have had a smile on their face.
And they would not have been hungry.
Exactly. You know, when Bella cut her finger and that one of the vampires, like, practically lunch on her, I'm like, how do you walk past the women's toilets at school? Like,
oh, my God, you'd be eating out of the sanitary bin. That's so gross.
But, like, I feel like...
It hadn't occurred to me.
Well, it's occurred to you now, hasn't it?
It really has. What used to occur to me is she would snuggle against him and he was cold. Like, I don't snuggle against anything that's cold unless I've got food poisoning, you know what I mean?
I guess it'd be good if you had a fever, then you'd just have an instant ice pack.
And, like, then sex for that... anyway, moving on.
Maybe she likes a cold penis.
Maybe she's really hot down there.
Oh my god. Is this appropriate, like, variant?
Just forget where I work. I just had a thought before we went right into let's not talk about Twilight. Let's talk about Twilight and go right into a really gross area. Anyway, not that menstruation is gross, by the way.
It's sadly underrepresented in women's fiction, I feel. But yeah. Maybe we just don't want to think about it. Like, if we're going to be women's fantasy and escapism, I mean, not to say that romance doesn't do other things, but primarily that's what it is. It's a little bit of, there's a fantasy element to romance. Then maybe we just don't want to dwell on periods.
Probably not. I mean, usually if it's discussed, it's because you've missed one and you've got an accidental baby.
I do find that so I've been reading a lot of Filipino romance. In almost every story I've read, there's been a mention of periods.
Oh.
Either in passing or, like, just I'm having periods right now, so I'm in a bad mood.
Yeah.
Or as part of discussion about sex. And that the heroes aren't grossed out or anything. It's just part of life.
Yeah.
I wonder if it's a cultural thing.
Maybe. I'm not entirely sure. I think, you know, also masturbation doesn't come up much in YA.
Right.
And I feel like with such a large proponent of female authors and female readership that would come up more. But I think it could have something to do with the... I mean, particularly in Australia, a large amount of the YA-buying public are actually schools and school libraries. And if you think about which schools have money and have money for library budgets,
but you know,
that's religious schools.
Okay,
so,
But I read Maestro for my HSC. That has sex in the library, which as a librarian probably icks you out because think of the books. I think it's got sex on a swing in the patio or something. So I feel like masturbation shouldn't be such a big deal. And unless you actually just focus on a particular book, most parents aren't even going to really know that it's there.
Yeah.
Is it that because it's Australian, it gets a pass?
Ooh.
And that one was male protagonist as well. So I feel like, you know, if Maestro can be seen as worthy of HSC study and it's got, you know, sexual activity, like, why should that stop?
Yeah, look, the VCE, what I know about is the Victorian curriculum, is chosen by people who know what they're talking about, but they try to bring more and more books onto the list, but they're looking for literary, and a lot of time they talk about critical rigour, and that they do believe that there isn't enough to be critical about or to... you know, go into that sort of deep analysis that they want to have. I think that's just dismissing an entire category of literature. And if I can say anything about Australian literature, YA literature, it's extremely well written. It's typically is literary or is close to. And once upon a time, we were the most progressive area of YA in the world. I don't think we're there anymore, sadly.
What do you think has changed? In what way are we less progressive now, do you think?
We are primarily Australian YA, as it stands, is written by white, cis, middle-class females. We're not really representing enough LGBT, people of colour, religion, disability. But diversity isn't the whole conversation. I also think that... I do think the dominance of the schools market is having a role in that.
It's interesting you say that, because Melina Marquetta's breakout book was Looking for Ollie Brundy, yep. Which is all about the immigrant experience, someone who felt like she wasn't quite, she wasn't typical of the, I guess, the majority of her classmates. So I find that really interesting.
Yeah, so think about it. It's about identity. It's about setting. It's about our migrant experience. What are those three things that we study quite a lot at school? And that's not to take away from Marquetta, because I'm the biggest fangirl there is about Melina Marquetta. And she wrote that when she was 24. I mean, how's that for freaking impressive?
And she wasn't even sort of trained in writing. She just kind of wrote it.
She was a bank teller. I was about to say that. She ended up having to teach that book because it was in the curriculum to her class of boys. So, which is great to hear her speak about if you ever get
the chance. I would love to have done the HSC and be taught by the author of the book that we were studying.
Yeah.
It would have been amazing.
It would have been amazing.
You could write on your essay, well, as Melina Marquetta said in my lecture.
But my concern is, if you know what the curriculum is and you know what a library has a restricted budget and you think about what they need to cover, that you could potentially write to those markers.
So is it the case that...
sex isn't one of them.
Right.
Yeah.
Of course. So is it the case that if we want more diversity in YA, we need to encourage schools to start looking at reading lists that are more diverse since they're the primary buyers?
Oh, I would totally agree with that. A lot of schools apparently aren't very familiar with Magabala Books, which is an Indigenous publishing
house.
Who's that? Magabala Books, which is an Indigenous publishing house.
Well, I mean, Indigenous characters and authors is another big thing because even when we talk about diversity, they're still kind of marginalised in the conversation when they should be one of the first topics of conversation.
I completely agree. Anne Boleyn Quay Molina, who's an Indigenous writer in Australia and writes amazing spec fic, has constantly been pushing this agenda, has written some amazing pieces that can be found on Danielle Binks's blog, Alpha Reader, about helping librarians find diverse reads, about helping book buyers do it, and readers. And so I went through each post with a guide. Look, the problem is, one person of one representing one point of diversity or multiple points of diversity is not the sole voice of that, those labels, for lack of a better
word.
Groups, yeah. So I am white, straight, middle class.
You're the majority group.
South Australian with a propensity for F-bombs. Now, I don't have the same opinions as everyone of me. And the problem with YA is there's an assumption that teens are these empty vessels ready to be filled, good or bad. And the thing is, you wouldn't line up myself, with a whole bunch of 35-year-olds and say they're going to like everything, that they're going to like this book. And that's what we kind of assume as students, and that's not fair and it's not right. Regardless of whether you're into literary or commercial or you want vampires that sparkle or if you want vampires who F. You know, now I'm getting to talking about school, so I'm taking the swearing out. But
it's too late for that. I think we've killed that vote.
But I'm going to say, you know, I like reading romance. I've stopped apologising for it in the last 4 years. I used to not discuss it at all. I've become a bigger part of the community, and they're all really lovely, and I really like helping younger people find the stuff that they like. And the thing is, there's so much in romance. You can find something you like. And whilst representation in romance isn't where it could potentially be, I do believe it's ahead of many other areas and is much more accessible, thankfully.
So tell us a little bit about romance collections in libraries. Are we seeing anything new happening? What's exciting in that area?
To be frank, I'm not. I work at a library. I'm not. I don't work on collections and acquisitions in terms of the library. The State Library does collect anything that's printed in Victoria, but so, I'm not part of that.
So, one of the things that I'm fascinated by is the concept of legal deposit in Australia, which is that any book that's published in Australia by an Australian author. The libraries have a legal obligation to keep at least one copy, I think.
Depending
on the city where it was first published or something like that.
It's in a different department. I work in a wonderful organisation of many hundreds of people.
No, I know that, but I'm just...
It's not just books. It's actually CDs, political ephemera. It's
zines.
Also,
I mean, did one zine and we submitted it for legal deposit.
So I'm sure they have every copy of Playboy Australia that's ever been printed. They collect everything. It's such an important part of the history of our country, and people don't really realise libraries do that.
And they do digital book collections now as well.
Yes, they do. I think that's still a process getting fine tuned.
Yeah,
but
so I think they have it. So there are digital media that they proactively collect.
Mm-hmm.
But when I queried them on Twitter, I think the answer I got was that if you are digitally published, you can submit your work voluntarily.
Yeah, it's the voluntarily part that I was aware of.
But I mean, I feel like if you're a self-published author, this should be something you look at, because once they have it in the collection, you're on Trove, you're searchable.
Oh, indeed. But I think some people aren't aware that it happens at all.
That's
and
right.
That's the problem. And it's also the problem, coming back to YA, is there's a movement right now in Australia called Love Oz YA, is that a lot of readers just don't know the difference between Australian and US or any other country, for that matter. I do. I've been reading it for 20 years. But you're forgetting a 13 or 14-year-old's been reading YA for 1 year. So when we talk about derivative YA, they don't know any different. They've read that book for the first time. It's mind-blowing. They don't care that it's derivative of Battle Royale instead of The Hunger Games, you know.
Do you get a sense of how YA readers start getting into the YA books?
It's pop culture now. It's Hunger Games. It's Divergent. It's some games. some gaming. It could be, I think, with what's happening with Marvel and DC right now, and we're going to have a whole line of Marvel YA novels coming out in the next year. They started with Black Widow, I believe, at the end of last year, which wasn't a book that I thought was great. But I think
it's an entry to better books.
Yeah, I would go to a comic, and I do think comics are youth literature as well, and there are amazing comics out there. Kamala Khan, Marvel's new Ms. Marvel.
My kids read them, and my kids are preteen.
Yeah, and Lumberjanes, there's heaps of stuff there, and people forget that Australian comics actually started out really quite strongly with the romance.
What about price points? In Australia, what are the price points for YA? Because when I read...
$16.99 and sometimes
it's like... freaking high.
$18 to $20.
Like, teens would have to save up to buy a book.
Yeah, I would never have had that money growing up. I mean, I was a country area, so I didn't even have a bookstore. And the problem is e-books are equally as expensive.
Well, and e-books, you need a device.
Yes. So it'd be, and a credit card.
Yeah.
Or
PayPal.
Yeah.
So,
because I totally had a credit card at 14. I don't know about you.
Yeah, no. Actually, I got a credit card solely to be able to buy Mills and Boone subscription.
I was a Baker's Delight lady in the Culottes. It was a really scarring time. It's not flattering on anyone, believe me, but there were free custard scrolls. And I would go to the secondhand bookstore and buy 3 Mills and Boone for $2. And that would get me through a day.
Is there an equivalent of the Mills and Boone in YA, the short format, easy to buy in terms of price and accessibility, but largely disposable in the sense that it's only published for limited time? I mean, I know we call them disposable fiction, but a lot of readers have keepers.
All right. So what I would say, this is probably not true, but there was a girlfriend series from Allen and Unwin about 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah, that didn't seem very successful to me, unless I just didn't see it because I wasn't the market.
I think they had like 20 books. I'm not entirely sure about this, and I think it did okay, but they haven't repeated the experience, so I guess it wasn't that successful. But there were some great reads in there, so Penny Russin's, I remember quite fondly, his little bird. Might have to come back to you on that one.
Because Dolly had a collaboration like in the 80s or 90s, and some really prominent authors were writing under pseudonyms.
Margot Lanigan.
Yeah. Oh my God, I actually bought a couple of her books from that time.
She would have loved that.
Well, yeah. She was like, do I have to tell you what the books were?
Margot Lanigan's the best. I'm just like getting all fangirly. What we were talking about, disposable. That's, I think, where the free book on iBooks comes in, which is apparently an Australian-only thing we were hearing about the other day. Also, if you think about new adult, it's $1 books, potentially. And a lot of them are free because they're trying to get people involved in the series.
So you think the Kindle, the super Kindle discounts are replacing the sort of news agency
books? If you have some money, yes. But actually, I would say that fan fiction is entirely it.
So let's talk about fan fiction.
Oh, please.
What role do you think fan fiction plays in reading lives?
Huge. If you see people complain about teens being on their phones all the time, I'm like, well, one, adults are on their phones all the time, so shut up. And two, if you look at a picture from the 1940s, people in public transport, they're all looking at their newspapers. It's no different. I'm sure some of them are reading the comics and doing the crosswords too. So if you're doing Sudoku, that's fine. Fan fiction's huge, huge. And in terms, it can be the written kind, it can be artwork, it can be anything. And I love it. It's free. And there's lots of it. And some of it is really well written. And it's also representing people that are not represented in traditional media. So
I must admit, the times when I've been driven to fan fiction, it's been for Australian police procedural shows, and there's like almost
like Blue Healers.
No, that's a really old, like Rush.
Okay,
I really loved Rush. The guy who was in the Anna Karenina remake.
I know who you mean. It's gone. Drazik.
No, I don't know. He's got a really, it's sort of common sounding name, and it's so hard to remember.
Everyone's yelling at us right now.
Yes. What about the writers' festivals that do sort of erotic fanfic presentation. So I know City Writers, I don't know if Melbourne Writers had them, but I know City Writers for some years had like Marie Cardi, Benjamin Law. I have mixed feelings about those because I don't know whether they're authentic fan fiction offerings or whether they're there for laughs.
So I went to one last month at the Wheeler Centre in Melbourne. I cannot tell you any of the people that did their stories, sadly. But what was really interesting is they had four comedians, one female. The female one was fantastic. It was between two politicians, but both male. And the following three stories were all about male. And yes, funny, but it felt a bit like, making them gay, you know? And it felt really uncomfortable. Like, we just heard four stories that were for comedic effect and laughing about sex. But there was an edge that I didn't love.
Did it matter that it was real person fic rather than fictional characters? Because I find
one,
that
one
a little
of them
bit more
was, look, I don't watch My Kitchen Rules, Channel 7.
MKR, so My Kitchen Rules.
There was one of those about Manu and the guy that is stupid about paleo.
I don't even.
All right.
So no grains for.
Yeah, the paleo guy, Pete. I don't watch the show at all. I only know it from watching Twitter conversations. All right. So it was about them. And
I find real person fic a little bit uncomfortable. And there's some, actually, Tez Miller, who's an Australian blogger, sent a link to a book release announcement where it was a series of fanfic about real people, like Justin Bieber, you know, like celebrities. And even though they're celebrities, I always feel like they have personal lives. Maybe they don't want to, their actual real-life persona.
Yeah, that's where it gets really awkward because I do like reading Felicity Smoke and Oliver Queen. They're two characters, right? I love reading any kind of fan fiction. I'm going to go a bit further than that. People write fan fiction about the actor Stephen Amell and the actress Emily Bett Ricards, and I find that incredibly intrusive. I don't think that's okay at all. So I have a line, apparently.
I also think written fan fiction where the reader reads it and it's a community is somehow less intrusive than a performance of fan fiction work, where I just feel like performance puts a nuance to it that is public.
Yeah.
Whereas when you're reading, the way you interpret it is very private. And even if you comment on stuff on how you react to it, there's only so much you can share.
It's the mockery. It's the
cutting edge
to it that I don't like.
Yeah, and I think the fan fiction community writes fan fiction sort of with good intentions, in the spirit of loving the original text or the original show or even the actors of the show, whereas performative fan fiction sometimes feels to me exploitative and it's really about the performer rather than the fiction. Listen, you have to catch a flight soon, so I don't want to make you late for that. To finish off, your favourite authors?
I really like Cora Cormack. I'm a huge fan of Serena Bowen. It's my, like, I think she should be much bigger than what she is.
If I'm going to start with Serena Bowen, which book should I start with?
I'm not good with the titles. The first one.
Okay. If I were to do Cora Cormack, is it Cora or Cara?
If you're going to start with Serena Bowen, the first one in the series has actually a female ice hockey player who was really, really good and has an injury and she's now disabled as a result and when she goes to college, has to live on the first floor of the dorm room. And it's very isolated from everybody else. Just so happens that an ice hockey player from the varsity team has broken his leg and has to be on the bottom floor on the other side of the hall. But the best thing about it is that they are friends for a while. It actually develops. It's not an instant, wow, I want it. She kind of really likes him a lot from the beginning, but there is actually a friendship that develops. I'm really into Mariana Zapata at the moment, which I know is not a lot of people love it because sexy times don't come in for a really long time. But
God, people, be patient for God's sake.
But I really like it. There's a soccer one. There is a rock star one, and there is. I'm going blank, but I really like it. One of them is a non-verbal German soccer coach who is kind of amazing. It's called Lingus, which sounds a bit naughty. Nice.
So that's okay, because I'll email you for these titles and I'll add them to the show notes.
Please do. I've got heaps more. I'll put a post up as well.
Okay, cool, and we'll link to that. Anyone in Australia that you've think is doing particularly well?
Melina Marchetta, obviously.
And, but she's not writing.
No,
new adult, young adult.
But please read The Piper's Son, Cunnilingus. I did mention
I love The Piper's Son.
Well, Kylie Scott is talked about as NA, but I don't think she is, actually, at all.
Not even her rock star romance? That's pretty NA-ish. But, you know, the thing is, I find, like, if you're a successful band with, like, lots of money, I feel like that's not the typical NA experience anymore.
No. No, I don't think so either. Who else am I reading? I think, look, it's really late at night and I've been at this event for 6 days.
I've put you under pressure.
I am beginning to talk like Cher. I actually have lots of new adult recommendations. And what I'll do is Kat will tell me when this goes live and she can give me, I can give her a link. Of
everything. Yeah, so it'd be great if you had like a starter list for people. Mm. And so, you know, and we can group them like if you like.
Do some read-alikes. And if you've got any questions for me, just I'm on Twitter at SnarkyWench. And I'll do what I can. Yeah.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for
having
me.
I hope you enjoyed the convention.
I really did. Well, you know, it's an interesting one. It's a marathon, that's for sure. I was a virgin this year, as were you.
We got deflowered at the same time.
It wasn't that painful.
No, it was very pleasurable.
And we've met some really
amazing
people.
There was no blood
people.
Involved.
Or vampires.
No vampires.
Alas, we have once again reached the end of an episode. You can find the show notes at bookthingo.com.au/podcast. Just click on episode 23. And this show also marks the end of the series of conversations we recorded at the Romantic Times convention. As always, massive thanks to our unflagging audio producer, Rudy Bremer. I think these recordings had some of the most challenging audio noise that she's had to contend with for the podcast, and she has done a phenomenal job. So thank you, Rudy. Also related to RT was a tweet we got from Nicola O, who tweets as alpha_heroes. She said, "I have finally figured out podcasts. I've been listening to the Bookthingo podcasts while working on my BookCon scrapbook. It's perfect, especially the ones you did at RT while I'm working on RT pages." Nicola and I actually met in Seattle before RT, where Nicola generously treated me to the best pub food I had in the States. So thank you, Nicola. And thanks for being one of my RT buddies and making it such a memorable convention for me. If you enjoyed the podcast, you can support us by leaving a review on iTunes or telling your reader friends to give us a try or sending us your feedback via tweet at BookThingo or via email at podcast@bookthingo.com.au. You can also visit the blog to check out reviews and opinions from a bunch of readers from down under, including me and Rudy. In the next episode, I'm joined once again by my co-bloggers Rudy and Gabby. I have absolutely no idea what we're going to talk about, but as you may have noticed by now, that's never actually stopped us before. Until then, I hope you have a fabulous fortnight of reading.